Today is April 4th, and this is The Rewind, your Sunday news magazine. I'm Robert Kaplan. On today's episode, Rewind reporter Ty Blitstein shares his conversations with the University Chaplaincy about its deepening focus on social justice and its upcoming Russell Lecture on Spiritual Life. Delivering the lecture is Reverend Adam Russell Taylor, who is the president of Sojourners, a nonprofit that aims to integrate faith with social justice. More on that later in today's episode. First, a discussion with Jack Hirsch about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the city of Medford's finances. Hello, Jack. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Great, of course. Let's get started. So first, let's talk about the revenue situation in Medford. To what extent, what are some numbers? How is it the extent of its impact from COVID-19? Tax receipts? Let's talk about it.
Yeah, sure. So in the presentation that the financial director gave to Medford City Council, she outlined how it affected fiscal year 2020 and fiscal year 2021. For fiscal year 20, there was a budget shortfall of around $1 million. It was projected to be around $20 million, and it came out to be around $19 million. And then as they were projecting the budget for fiscal year 2021, they projected it to be in the ballpark of more around $15 million. So that would be an around $14 million shortfall from the previous year.
What are the sources of this shortfall? Are these sales taxes, property taxes? What can you say?
So this is almost entirely due to the pandemic and the recession that it caused. So most of Medford's tax revenue comes from property taxes, which is usually the most stable tax revenue in a recession, just because it doesn't fluctuate depending on people buying things or people losing their job. But a lot of revenue still comes from restaurant meal taxes, taxes on things like hotels. And as we know, because of the pandemic, people weren't booking rooms in hotels, people weren't eating out in restaurants, and things like that can really impact the tax revenue.
To the extent you can say, what sort of consequences does this have for Medford's government?
So in March of 2020, they implemented a hiring freeze and a non-emergency spending freeze. And then they had to reinstate that again in January of 2021 due to the resurgence of the pandemic. For the average Medford community member, they haven't really seen any services cuts because of the measures that the city government has taken in place, like the hiring freeze and the non-emergency spending freeze.
Okay, right. An additional point here, is it clear yet from what you've talked to with sources in Medford, the extent of aid that Medford's getting from the American Rescue Plan, the federal legislation passed? I'm sure that it has some state and local aid in there, but do we know the extent that it affects Medford yet?
So I don't have any specific number of how much they're receiving. I do know that when I spoke to Medford city officials, what they wanted was somewhere in the multi-million dollar range. And then looking into the American Rescue Plan Act, I think the number is $65.1 billion to cities around the country, but I do not know specifically how much Medford will get. I think it's based on a decision made through a formula by the Community Development Block Grant, but I'll have to follow up.
Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about Medford's planned expenditures, to the extent that it's boosted by some of this infused grant aid or not. We've, had some recent reporting done by you about planned expenditures in the coming year. Is that correct?
This was the coming 6 years.
Coming six years. Big difference between a year and 6 years. Well, tell us a little bit about it. What's the extent of that planned investment, the timeline, and its planned effects?
Yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, the Medford mayor released a capital investment plan. And this is a plan for capital investment for over the next 6 years. It totals around $107 million for around 103 different capital projects across the city. And when I say capital project, I mean things like police cruisers or maybe a fire department building, roads and bridges, school buildings, operating school buildings and maintaining those. So things like that.
Right. How does this fit in with precedent for public expenditure by City of Medford? Is this big, bold, and new, or is this part of a, you know, a tradition of capital investment plans?
So I believe that this is a new type of plan that hasn't been introduced before, taken on by the Medford mayor who was recently elected. So I believe it's not typically done. The plan is more of a roadmap. So the things in the plan aren't set in stone. They can be changed at any time due to shifting circumstances. I believe this plan is the first of its kind for Medford. It's a new initiative taken on by the Medford mayor, newly elected Medford mayor. And it was worked on in conjunction with the Edward J. Collins Center at UMass Boston.
Okay, great. And so there's addressed in this plan something on the order of like 120 projects, right?
Yep.
How were those determined? What's the process for figuring out which projects are in and out?
Yeah. So there's in general two phases. The first phase, people at the Collins Center, along with the people in the mayor's office, meet with all the different department heads in the city. And then those department heads will present their needs, what they think needs to be done around like how much that will cost, and just the general plan of what the next 6 years, what investments they need. And the second part of that phase is to sort of evaluate what resources Medford has, do some capital planning, and prioritize the timing of which project should be done. And then, yeah, they create that priorities list and then they release the plan.
You mentioned Medford's own resources as it stands. This is an expensive series of projects. Surely, is it already clear where the money is coming from, or is it planned out of future revenue for these investments?
I'm not sure, like specifically where the revenue is coming from. I think just in general, like their tax revenue. It helps that the American Rescue Plan Act was passed, and Medford will be receiving funding. When I spoke to City of Medford officials, they did not know yet how the funding received from the American Rescue Plan would impact this plan yet.
What are responses from sources that you've talked to about these two issues, especially, you know, interaction with each other? The planned expenditures by Medford, this, you know, big plan for 6 years of investment, and also its revenue shortfalls, whether it's Medford residents, city councilors. What are some of the reactions you've been getting?
Yeah, sure. So the city council reaction to the financial report that we talked about earlier, you know, they said it was pretty bleak, that we're in a recession, that it looks like there's going to be tough times ahead, and that we need a plan for that. And then for this plan, there was generally positive reaction from the city council. City Council President Richard Caraviello complimented the mayor, saying that there's no, you know, pie in the sky projects, as he put it. He did mention, though, that funding will be the biggest issue. And he talked about, you know, it has to be done through either raising taxes, 2.5 override, debt exclusion grants, or other types of state and federal funding. And then City Council Vice President complimented the Collins Center, although he did feel like there were some projects that were left out that he would have preferred to see a pit in, such as resurfacing, more of an emphasis on resurfacing the roadways, and a better idea of the future plans for the fire department headquarters. And those were the general reactions from the city council.
So in some of these issues, is there anything else that you think we should know?
I think one important thing to point out is that when I was talking, I did the report on the budget shortfall in the middle of March when the new stimulus bill was still in Congress and I wasn't sure if it was being passed yet. And it was mentioned over and over again. We don't know what's going to happen. If this isn't passed, it's going to be a lot worse. And sort of we were looking to President Biden and hoping that the new Congress will pass this measure. And so the measure was passed. So I think that gave a lot of Medford City officials a sigh of relief.
Excellent. Well, Jack, thank you so much for your time. It's been lovely speaking with you.
Thank you for having me.
The proposed $107.6 million capital investment plan is the work of Medford Mayor Brianna Longo-Kern who was first elected to that office in November 2019. This episode was brought to you by Tufts University College, where undergraduates and graduates alike can experience Tufts this summer. Registration is now open. Learn more about the variety of courses available at go.tufts.edu/daily. In the news this week, Tufts on March 17th announced that it will close the school's Confucius Institute. The Confucius Institute at Tufts first opened in 2015 with the mission of providing additional Chinese language and culture programming and facilitating cooperation between Tufts and Beijing Normal University. The announcement to close the institute comes after renewed attacks against the Chinese government-sponsored program as a medium for enhancing the image of the Chinese Communist Party. At its peak, there were more than 100 Confucius Institutes at colleges, universities, and K-12 schools across the nation. As of March 25th, 50 institutes, including Tufts, remained operational. Somerville City Councilor Katiana Ballantyne has entered the Somerville mayoral race. Ballantyne represents Ward 7 and has served 4 terms as a city councilor, having been elected twice as president of the council. So far, only businessman William Taro and Ballantyne have entered the race. Councilor-at-large Kristen Strezzo has called on the city of Somerville to declare a state of emergency for women. The resolution was proposed on February 25th and was co-sponsored by Councilor Ballantyne. Strezzo says the resolution is in response to the COVID-19 pandemic's disproportionate effect on women in the workforce. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, women have suffered greater jobs losses due to the pandemic. TEDx Tufts began its 7th annual speaker series on Thursday and will be hosting talks through this Wednesday. You can attend talks in person on the Tisch Library roof with social distancing guidelines monitored throughout. Attendees are required to purchase tickets, which can be accessed at TEDxTufts.com. Upcoming this week, the Tufts Chinese fusion dance group Wuzi is putting on its 4th annual production this Friday at 8 p.m. The theme of this year's performance is Breeze and Bamboo, symbolizing strength that is both gentle and resilient. Be sure to RSVP on Facebook to gain access to the virtual performance. The Tufts Active Minds chapter is hosting its first mental health dialogue on Thursday. Active Minds is a nationwide nonprofit with the goal of promoting campus mental health through student leadership. The talk will be held at 7 on Thursday. Pre-registration is required and can be found at tufts.presence.io. Do you have a community event you'd like to share on the show? If so, send a quick email to tuftsdailyaudio@gmail.com with the event's information. On April 7th, the chaplaincy is hosting its annual Russell Lecture on Spiritual Life. Reverend Adam Russell Taylor will deliver a talk titled The Work Ahead, Building a Just, Beloved Community, which will focus on the intersection of spirituality and social justice work. The talk's theme is part of a larger effort within the chaplaincy to deepen its work on issues of social justice. Ty Blitstein has the story.
For the Reverend Adam Russell Taylor, social justice is synonymous with relationships.
And so for me, justice at its core is about trying to establish and restore right relationship between people. And in order for that to happen, we have to address all of the forces that prevent people from thriving or being able to experience their full human dignity.
Taylor's own lifelong fight for social justice was inspired at an early age.
You know, I really grew up in the shadow of the civil rights struggle. I grew up in the late 70s, early 80s. And I really felt that my generation inherited the unfinished business of the civil rights struggle. And so for me, like the work of justice personally has been about learning from that history and kind of trying to take that baton forward and understand that we got to do it in some different ways.
Throughout his career, Taylor, an author and ordained Baptist minister, has worked to take that baton forward by drawing on his Christian faith. He's led the Faith Initiative at the World Bank Group, worked as the vice president in charge of advocacy at World Vision US, and currently serves as president of Sojourners, a 50-year-old nonprofit organization with a mission of, quote, faith in action for social justice.
Faith itself requires us to put our beliefs, our commitments into action. So for me, action, activism is integral. It's part and parcel to Christian discipleship.
On April 7th, Taylor will virtually deliver the Tufts Chaplaincy's annual Russell Lecture on Spiritual Life. Established in 1867, it's the oldest lectureship at Tufts University. He previewed his address in an interview with The Rewind.
And yeah, I'm excited to kind of cast a moral vision for what I think could help bridge some of the deep divides in our country and really help us unite us around a commitment, a greater commitment to building a radically more just and inclusive America.
The Reverend Taylor's talk is titled The Work Ahead, Building a Just Beloved Community, a topic inspired by an animating vision of the civil rights movement and made all the more relevant by the divisiveness and partisanship within the United States today.
I've been really heartbroken and anguished by the degree of vitriol and contempt and division that we see within our body politic. I think we're kind of at this really crucial inflection point as a nation, where we could either go down the route of a politics of division and, you know, see these divisions really tear us apart, or we can try to unite around a politics of the common good, a politics of the beloved community.
Taylor said he plans to share more in his address about how to do just that. The theme of this year's lecture is part of a growing focus on social justice within the Tufts chaplaincy and the university as a whole.
The Russell Lecture is designed to lift up spiritual voices of many different kinds, you know, over the years, and invite them to think about how spirituality and interfaith work connect with the urgent issues of our time. I knew that for this year's Russell Lecture, I wanted for the chaplaincy to be able to bring in a speaker who could speak directly to the questions that we're living and the commitments we're making as an institution. Related to anti-racism and engagement in a democratic society in a time of incredible strife and change.
That's University Chaplain Reverend Elise Nelson Winger. She is responsible for leading spiritual life at Tufts University. Nelson Winger shared what social justice means to her and how it connects to her faith.
Well, for me, social justice begins with the conviction about the inherent dignity, equality, and worth of every human being. And it's from that foundation that the work of social justice always begins. And that means that where there are barriers to any person being able to live out of that inherent dignity, equality, and worth, that we as people and communities have work to do to make sure those barriers are broken down. Well, for me, it comes from a recognition within my own faith tradition and also my engagement with people of many different faiths that at the core of the world's great religious and philosophical traditions is this commitment to lifting up the inherent dignity of each person. And with it, the call for people together to build a society that allows for that for each person to flourish.
Some of that work is now being done by the 8 distinctive chaplaincies that make up the larger university chaplaincy, each of which represents a different faith tradition. The Protestant chaplaincy, for instance, hosts an LGBTQ-focused Pride in the Pews service, while the Catholic chaplaincy hosts a spirituality hour dedicated to social teaching and discussion. Meanwhile, recently appointed interim Buddhist chaplain Harsha Menon is currently working on bringing programs to the Tufts campus relating to food justice and social justice for women in Buddhist communities.
The university chaplaincy has been growing and diversifying for years. And the university has been committed to providing the resources so that we can grow, because we want to reflect the rich religious diversity of our campus. And we can't do that without equipping and empowering and supporting 8 different chaplains. And there's still growth to be had. So to me, that's a really good sign, because representation matters. And making sure that students, particularly from underrepresented religious and spiritual traditions, feel like they are seen and have the support they need, to me, that's a social justice commitment.
The idea of social justice is integral to other chaplaincy-wide events as well, like the annual Martin Luther King Jr. Symposium. Nelson Winger discussed how the work of the chaplaincy is related to the university's initiative to become an anti-racist institution.
I feel like this is a really important time at Tufts. We have a lot of good and important and urgent work to do. And the university chaplaincy is committed to coming alongside that. So, you know, if we're not including both the spiritual resources and provocations of our many traditions when we're doing anti-racism work, I don't think we're doing it fully. We need to come at this work from every possible angle and perspective. And for students and faculty and staff for whom spiritual and religious identity and practices are paramount or important, we need to create spaces for sustained reflection about how these practices inform our actions, our love in action day by day as we seek to change systems and also change ourselves. And where do we need to, and where can we let our traditions both challenge us? And then where do we need to interrogate and reckon with our traditions as well in the places where they have contributed actually to injustice? That is very serious and important work, and we can't do the anti-racism work without bringing that lens as well.
Nelson Winger expanded on just how the chaplaincy has responded to the ongoing recommendations made as part of this initiative.
And we're asking ourselves as a team, you know, when these recommendations came out from the different work streams, we're saying, how do we see ourselves as chaplains and advisors and staff contributing to these recommendations? How are we going to be a part of offering anti-racism and anti-oppression education, for example? What does it look like for chaplains to be a part of a multi-resource model when it comes to campus policing and safety? What do restorative justice practices and mutual accountability really look like? And how can the chaplaincy be a part of that? And what internal work do we need to do as a chaplaincy?
Nelson Winger made sure to acknowledge the internal work still yet to be done within the chaplaincy itself.
We have to be able to dismantle the oppression that's in our own systems and that we've foisted on others in order to retrieve that, I think, genuine core call to do justice and love kindness. Most chaplaincies have a very central Protestant and or Catholic history. And while we have diversified and have grown since then, there's still a lot of decentering of white Christianity that needs to be done so that we're making equitable and flourishing space for all of us to be able to work together. And so that's really important work that I hope that we will and trust that we will do together.
She also emphasized the importance of collaboration in working for social justice.
I don't think that the chaplaincy could exist without collaboration. We work together internally all the time.
The chaplains also work externally with non-faith-based campus organizations, like the identity-based centers, to provide programming and companionship, as they did in response to anti-Asian discrimination and violence within the United States.
Chaplaincy partnered with the Asian American Center to provide a space for processing and healing with our Hindu advisor, Preeta Banerjee, and someone from CMHS and the AAC. And that's an example of how we want to be in the moment, working to be with and for students. And we do that with our colleagues across campus.
The Reverend Nelson Winger also represents the chaplaincy on a number of social justice-focused university committees, including the Mental Health Steering Committee, the Institutional Audit Committee for the University's Anti-Racism Initiative, and the Bias Education and Resource Team, which bring together people from across the Tufts community.
We have to work together. It's so important because the more perspectives that we have, the more professional disciplines represented, the better work we're going to do on behalf of the entire campus.
part of this collaboration also includes working with students, such as those who sit on the Interfaith Student Council. The council is made up of representatives from each of the chaplaincy's religious, philosophical, and spiritual organizations who meet weekly to reflect on current global issues, plan activism and service events, and engage in interfaith dialogue.
And they're also an important sounding board for me and for other members of the chaplaincy team. I seek out their wisdom. Certainly part of my hope and vision coming into this role is that we are speaking to the issues of the time. I want us to be relevant. I want us to listen to students, to what their both their hopes are and also what their hurts are. And I want to make sure we're coming alongside them. And if we are listening to students, that means we're going to forefront climate justice and racial justice and justice of all kinds in our work. So to me, that is an absolutely central commitment.
This includes the 41% of students who, according to the chaplaincy's Fall 2020 Spiritual Demographic Survey, identify as agnostic, atheist, or non-religious.
I want for the chaplaincy to be known as a place that creates community for people, no matter their backgrounds or beliefs, and that we thrive in that diversity, and that the more perspectives we have, the richer our conversations are going to be. Spiritual practices don't require a religious identity. There are so many ways of meaning making and community forming and justice doing that are enriched by non-religious and philosophical understandings. So we can't be who we are as a chaplaincy without everybody.
The Reverend Adam Russell Taylor similarly spotlighted the power of students in the ongoing struggle for social justice, a fact he hopes to highlight in his upcoming lecture.
I really believe passionately in the role of students in the time, like the time window when you are a college student, as being not just formative, but essential for kind of what kind of enables you and can form you into a lifelong advocate for justice. And students have so often been on the vanguard of social change. Certainly saw that in the civil rights struggle, but it's also true in the anti-apartheid struggle and many other social movements. And so I'm a big believer in the power of student activism. And it doesn't mean that everyone has to be involved in the same way. Not everyone has to be, you know, the ones that are on the streets demonstrating, as much of that as that's important. But I do think that there's kind of this activist, if you will, or activism is embedded in every student in some shape or form. It's like a sleeping lion that's just waiting to wake up. And so I really hope that, you know, my talk can help to encourage and enliven that line of activism for justice in everyone that's listening and gets to engage in the dialogue.
For Taylor, university chaplaincies play an integral role in making this happen.
I think, you know, a chaplain office, an office of religious life on a college campus is an extremely important vehicle for connecting students and young people between, you know, their values, which are often shaped by faith, with what does that actually mean for our community and our city and our nation and our world, and the kind of community and nation and world that we want to co-create together. I think that spirituality is a really powerful engine for social change.
For The Rewind, I'm Ty Blitzstein.
The Chaplaincy's annual Russell Lecture on Spiritual Life will be Thursday from 4 p.m. to 5:15 p.m. You can register for the event by visiting chaplaincy.tufts.edu/russell-lecture. And that's it for this March 14th edition of The Rewind. Join us next week for more stories from the Tufts Daily.
The Rewind is brought to you by the Tufts Daily. Today's episode was produced in part by McKenna Law, with reporting by Sylvia Wang and me, Ty Blitzstein. Ryan Schaefer is producer of The Rewind. Kate Seckler selects our music. Our host is Robert Kaplan, and Hannah Harris is the executive audio producer. Thank you for listening.